human writer was Moses, with the possible exception of the book of Job. We don't know who wrote that. And chronologically, it's possibly the first book. It certainly predates the priesthood because Job was his own priest. But Moses, other than the book of Job, was the first human writer. He's about 1500 BC. The last one is Zechariah, and he's about 400 BC. So it spans over 1,000 years, written by several different people, different places, even occasionally different language, although largely Hebrew. And yet, it only has one theme. The Old Testament is not, strictly speaking, a Christian book. The Old Testament is a Jewish book, regarded by the Jews as being sacred. It has not been preserved by Christians, it has been preserved by Jews. Christians have had no part in its writing or in its preservation. The record has come to us strictly from Jewish hands. And so Christians cannot be accused of altering it in any way. They've had no say in its content. It was completed 400 years before Jesus Christ was born. Not only do the Jews regard it as a sacred book, so do the Muslims, although the Muslims accuse the Jews of altering it. But they still regard it as a sacred book, a genuine prophecy. And many well-versed Muslims are familiar with the Old Testament. It is a remarkable book for a number of reasons, one of which we're going to begin to look at now, and then we'll move on to look at one or two other ones. But in Ezekiel 26, we get a prophecy concerning the city of Tyre. Ezekiel 26, verse 1. In the 11th year, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me. A very specific date, specific occasion. God speaking to Ezekiel. When he says the 11th year, he's speaking of the 11th year after the fall of Jerusalem. Jerusalem fell in 586 BC. So this is then 575 BC. This is a prophecy, verse 2. Son of man, because Tyre has said of Jerusalem, ha ha, the gate to the nations is broken and its doors have swung open to me. Now that she lies in ruins, I will prosper. And this was the attitude of the city of Tyre. Tyre was one of twin cities in the land of Phoenicia, which is on the west coast and slightly north of Jerusalem. And the people of Tyre were celebrating the downfall of Jerusalem because the trade routes went through Jerusalem, and many people stopped there to barter, to buy food, to stay overnight, brought a lot of trade and wealth into Jerusalem. Now that Jerusalem was devastated by the armies of Nebuchadnezzar, instead of turning off to the right in Jerusalem, they went a little further, turned off to the left in Tyre, and Tyre began to be prosperous as a result of Jerusalem's downfall. And they were rejoicing then in Tyre about what had happened to Jerusalem. Of course, Jerusalem was God's own city, and he loved Jerusalem. So he says what he's going to do about Tyre, verse 3. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Tyre. And I will bring, notice the details of this, many nations against you, like the sea casting up its waves, just one after another. They will destroy the walls of Tyre and pull down her towers. I will scrape away her rubble and make her a bare rock. Out in the sea she will become a place to spread fish nets. For I have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. She'll become plunder for the nations, and her settlements on the mainland will be ravaged by the sword. Then they will know that I am the Lord. For this is what the Sovereign Lord says. From the north I'm going to bring against Tyre Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots, with horsemen and a great army. He will ravage your settlements on the mainland with a sword. He will set up siege works against you, build a ramp up to your walls, and raise his shields against you. He will direct the blows of his battering rams against your walls and demolish your towers with his weapons. His horses will be so many that they will cover you with dust. Your walls will tremble at the noise of the war horses, wagons, and chariots when he enters your gates, as men enter a city whose walls have been broken through. The hooves of his horses will trample all your streets. He will kill your people with a sword, and your strong pillars will fall to the ground. They will plunder your wealth and loot your merchandise. They will break down your walls and demolish your fine houses and throw your stones, timber, and rubble into the sea. I will put an end to your noisy songs, and the music of your harps will be heard no more. I will make you a bare rock, and you will become a place to spread fish nets. You will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. That was a very detailed prediction of what God was going to do to this city of Tyre. And as we said, the prophecy was made in the year 575. And the predictions are, Nebuchadnezzar will come against them. Nebuchadnezzar will conquer. There will be many nations like waves of the sea. Your stones, timber, and rubble will be put in the midst of the water. You'll become a bare rock. You'll become a place to spread fish nets, and you'll never be rebuilt. And that was all predicted in that particular time, 575. What ought to be said further to that is that in the whole of their history, Tyre had never been conquered. Tyre was on the coast, and it was built on a peninsula. This side is the Mediterranean Sea. And the city of Tyre was built here on the peninsula, and the only thing they had to defend was one wall, quite a short wall, across there. All of this area, there were very steep cliffs. Wasn't possible to land an ordinary boat there, and the cliffs were not really feasible for people to climb to raid the city. So all they had to do to survive was to just defend that one little wall. It seemed pretty easy to do, and it had been throughout their history. There was a lot of land enclosed in that, and they could graze their animals on there for quite a considerable period of time, several years before the pasture would be entirely worn away. There were also springs of water coming up there, sufficient to supply a reasonably large modern city. So they wouldn't run out of water, they wouldn't run out of food, and they had very little to defend. And throughout the whole history, many, many years, several hundred years, Tyre had never been defeated. But in that same year, Nebuchadnezzar attacked. Ezekiel said he would come from the north, and Babylon was in fact to the southeast, but the route that Nebuchadnezzar came, he did come down from the north. and he attacked in the same year. He besieged for quite a long time, and in 573, Nebuchadnezzar conquered the city of Tyre. And for the first time, the city was defeated. And Nebuchadnezzar broke up the wall here and shattered it, scattered it. And from that time on, it was relatively easy for anybody to attack the city because they never managed to get that wall rebuilt. And many little bandit tribes from the surrounding regions would ride in, particularly at night, and they would just ride straight over those walls and into the city, which didn't have any real defenses because nobody had ever breached the wall before. And they would attack the city and they would raid and carry off some wealth and ride off into the night. And it would happen again and again and again. And it kept on happening for quite a long time, actually, until the year 322. So for the next 250 years, many nations came, just one after the other, little bandit nations, hardly more than a small tribe. But they kept on stealing the wealth from the city. In 322, somebody new came on the scene. That was a gentleman by the name of Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great had a new hobby, which was called world conquest. And nobody had ever taken it quite that seriously before. But Nebuchadnezzar came from, Alexander the Great came from Greece with a very powerful army. And he rode into the city of Tyre, just as so many other people had done before him. But during this 250-year interval, the merchants of Tyre had succeeded in doing something very crafty. Half a mile off the mainland, and the water is very shallow, there is an island, a rather curious shape. It's even more curious. And this is also very rugged cliffs all the way around. It was just half a mile offshore, and the merchants of Tyre cut steps down the cliffs, and they kept a couple of small boats moored at the bottom. And they had men with trumpets who were to give warning of any attack. And when an attack came to the city, these guys blew their trumpets, and the merchants that had a little bit of wealth in gold or jewelry would scramble down their stairway into their little boats, and they'd go over to the island, and they would sail in here and into here, which is the one landing place, and a little settlement grew up there. And they would go over there and then go back again as soon as the danger was over. And so they did this when Alexander came to the city. And as they were going across in their little boats, this bit might not be true, this could be, it's a legend, but Alexander is supposed to have ridden up to the cliff tops on his white horse and looked at them escaping in their little boats over to the island. And they looked back at Alexander standing on the cliff tops, and they kind of insulted him, and they said, "You'll never catch us." And they rode off, apparently in safety, to the island across there. But that was a dangerous thing to do with somebody like Alexander, because he was an extremely angry young man, and he did not like to be thwarted. And he had something that none of the other armies had had before, and that was he also had a navy. And he had a very powerful navy. And he ordered his navy to go and capture the island. So the Greek navy set off to capture the island. But there was nowhere they could land on the island without coming through here. And this opening is so narrow, and it goes in through towering cliffs on either side. And the men on the island got up there on the cliffs, and as the Greek navy tried to sail through this narrow opening, what they did was to pour oil down on the boats, and then to drop blazing torches on them, and the whole thing became like a big barbecue. See, and there were lots of steaks sizzling in the flames, and the navy did not succeed in getting one boat through to land. And all the ships that tried it were wiped out. Alexander was angry and he sent them back again. He actually sent them five times. And every time the navy was repulsed and they couldn't capture the island. Alexander was not the type to give up easily. So he sent his army that had moved on and taken Egypt meanwhile. And he brought them back to the city of Tyre. And he made them dismantle every building in Tyre. And as I said, the water across here is very shallow. And all the stones were brought down and they were laid in the water in two columns. Right across to the island, half a mile. Then all the roof trusses and the big timbers, the beams, were brought down and they were put in a lattice across in between the two columns of stone. Then the soldiers had to carry on their shields heaps of rubble and dust from the buildings that they dismantled, bring it down and put that all in between the wooden lattice until they had built a solid causeway right across to the island. When that was done, the stones, timber, and rubble were in the midst of the ocean. And they had become like a bare rock. If you were to visit that place today, what you would see is this. The timbers and the rubble has long since washed out in the winter storms, but the main stones are still there, right across to the island. And if you were to go there in the early morning, you would find the local fishing fleet hanging up, and they do it every day, hanging up their nets to dry on the stones that had been the buildings of the city of Tyre. God said, you will become a place to spread fishing nets. And to this day, the city of Tyre, this is really the most surprising thing in some ways, this city has never been rebuilt. And they chose places for cities, not at random, they always had a reason for why they built a city in a particular place. They needed to be able to defend it. It needed to be near a trade route. It needed to be a good water supply, etc. And it had all these advantages, but it's never been rebuilt. Other cities, you'll find as many as 20 cities built one on top of the ruins of another. You'll find that with Jerusalem. You'll find it with Jericho. Tyre has never been rebuilt. To this day, it's not been rebuilt. And you can visit there, and you can still see the bare rock. You can see the fishermen spreading their fishing nets. And now, you see, this is 575 BC. Now we're talking about 1987 AD. 2,562 years. True. And over this progressive period, this prophecy has slowly unfolded and come through in all its detail, and it can be very simply verified. So the Old Testament is an amazing book because of its detailed prophecy that can be checked out and have come true in detail. There is a man who has written an interesting book that you might like to follow up. His name is Peter Stoner. He's a statistician, PhD, from somewhere in Illinois, if I remember correctly. He's written a book called Science Speaks. Publisher is Moody Press. And in that he deals, you won't agree with everything he says, but he, apart from some of the things you won't agree with, probably, he deals with a number of prophecies like this one, and he tries to estimate the statistical possibility of Ezekiel predicting this just from his own intelligence and the information available to him at the time. And he reckons that the statistical odds at their most conservative estimate are 1 in 75 million against Ezekiel getting that right just by chance and the information available to him. So the Old Testament is an amazing book for its fulfilled prophecies. Now if you'd turn please to Leviticus chapter 15, we'll find that it's an amazing book for another reason. Leviticus 15, the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any man has a bodily discharge, the discharge is unclean. Whether it continues flowing from his body or is blocked, it will make him unclean. This is how his discharge will bring about uncleanness. Now, I haven't asked you to turn to this one, but note down the reference, Deuteronomy 7, verse 15. In that, God says this, if you obey my laws, you will not suffer from any of the diseases you knew in Egypt. And he gave them quite a number of laws. This is one of them, detailed laws of what to do with people who have a skin disease, an infectious skin disease. And it's spelled out in some detail. There are a number of laws, and some of them were very simple health laws, like this one. When they were living in the desert, he said to them, if you need to go to the bathroom, you don't go in the camp, you go outside the camp. When you're going outside there, you will have taken with you something with which to dig, and you will dig a hole. And when you've dug the hole, you will do what you have to do, and then you'll fill the hole in again. And you must do that every time. Now that sounds a little primitive to you, no doubt, and probably it's a while since you did anything like that. But we're talking about 1500 BC. If we were to move forward 3,000 years from there to any of the great cities of the world, let's say Berlin, very beautiful city, advanced culture, civilized peoples, Berlin, 1500 AD. If you were wealthy and you needed to go to the bathroom, you'd use a gold bucket. And when you'd used it, a servant would come and take it away and take it to the back door and open the back door. And if you'd trained him properly, he would look to make sure no one was passing. And then he would empty the contents outside the back door into the street. If you're not wealthy, you'd use a tin bucket and you'd empty it yourself out of your one door into the only street. So the streets were in a very interesting condition, especially in the dry season. Even worse in the wet season. You can imagine the kind of diseases that developed from that insanitary procedure. Things like the Great Plague of London, the Black Death of Calcutta, many diseases like, for instance, cholera, a result of that kind of thing. Untold thousands of people have died in agony because of that. 3,000 years earlier, God told them what to do. And had they done that, those epidemics would never have happened and those diseases would have been eliminated. But people are always too smart to do what God tells them to do. They always think they know better. Here, what is to happen to the man with this discharge, this infectious skin disease? Verse 4. Any bed the man with a discharge lies on will be unclean. Anything he sits on will be unclean. Anyone who touches his bed must wash his clothes and bathe with water and be unclean till the evening. Whoever sits on anything the man with a discharge sat on must wash his clothes, bathe with water, be unclean till evening, etc. And it goes on in great detail. If anybody has had any kind of contact with this person that could result in the transmission of infection, that person is now unclean, and he stays unclean until sunset. That means he cannot work. It means he cannot worship. It means he cannot associate with anybody else. He's relieved of all responsibility for the rest of the day. He's got no pressing engagements. All his engagements are cancelled. All he's got to do is get clean. Wash himself and his clothes, and he's got all day to do it. Very simple, very effective. So the man is effectively isolated, the one with the disease, from passing that on to anybody else. Anything he touches, the clothes, etc., that he sat on, the bedding, is all unclean. If he uses a wooden vessel, it can be washed. If he uses a clay pot, it's to be smashed, never used again. The reason being that the clay was porous, it wasn't glazed, and you couldn't guarantee that you could get it clean, because the infection could go inside the porous clay and come out again at some later stage. So clay vessels were not to be used again if he'd touched them. After he is cleansed, if he is healed, he's to show himself to the priest, count off 7 days, and on the 7th day, or the 8th day rather, he's got to bathe with running water. Verse 13, NIV says fresh water, it's literally running water, and then he'll be clean. He's to wait a week to make sure he really is healed, and he's got to wash himself and his clothes under running water, and then he's clean. Then he can take his place in society again. A very simple but effective way of isolation. And that may seem very primitive, very childish to you, and no doubt it is. The only thing is, they could not understand in those days anything about infection, anything about little germs that you couldn't see that could be transferred from one person to another and could kill you. They didn't understand that. Egypt was the most advanced society of the day in Moses' time, and this was the standard of medicine in Egypt at the time. If you got a little bit of wood in your hand, we would call it a splinter, but different areas call it different things. Just a little piece of wood stuck in your hand. You would think the obvious thing to do would be to pull it out, wouldn't you? But not if you lived in Egypt in those days. You would make a little poultice out of worm's blood and donkey dung. And you wouldn't take the wood out, you'd just put that on the place where the wood had gone in. And you'd bind it up and leave it there. If you know much about things like sepsis, you would know what would happen. The wound would become infected, gangrene would set in, and the person would die. That was medicine in Egypt at the same time as God was giving these instructions to Moses about digging little holes in the desert and about keeping people with infectious diseases isolated. Just to let you see how very relevant that is, that was 1500 BC. Okay, and the man is to stay in isolation, when he's healed, wash himself under running water, and then be clean. We are going to come to the most advanced hospital in the world of its time. The date is 1847 AD, and the city is Vienna, Austria. And a doctor by name of Semmelweis, young doctor, actually Hungarian, but working in the hospital there in Vienna. He was in the gynecological ward, and he was concerned because one patient in every 6 that came into his ward died. And he thought those were rather bad odds. So he began to keep some careful records and statistics about everything that happened in his ward. And what he noticed was this, that just about every patient that died had been examined either by the professor of surgery or by one of his students. And in those days, this was the practice in the world's most advanced hospital. The professor of surgery came into the hospital early in the morning, along with his medical students, and they went to the mortuary where the dead bodies were. And they carved up the dead bodies to give some lessons in anatomy, and also to see if they could find out why this particular person had died. They went from there straight to the gynecological ward, because it was the nearest ward to the mortuary. And they went straight in there and started poking around on living patients. To us, it's so obvious what happened. If they picked up any kind of infection from any of those dead bodies, they transferred it immediately to the patients they looked at there in the ward of the living. Pretty simple, but they didn't understand that. And the chance of getting any sort of infection from a dead body is pretty high when you think about it. It's probably why it died in the first place. And dead bodies decay fairly fast. So, Semmelweis, just an experiment, said to the professor of surgery, "Would you please, when you leave the mortuary and before you come into my ward, wash your hands and your students?" The professor of surgery was absolutely furious. He said, "I'm an important man, I'm a busy man, my time is valuable, I haven't got time to waste on this nonsense." But Semmelweis insisted, and he did wash his hands and the students before they went into the ward. The statistics I found interesting. The procedure was instituted on the 1st of May, 1847. In the month of April, 57 patients died in that ward. In the month of May, one. I would regard that as a fairly significant fall in mortality. But Semmelweis continued to be unpopular. He continued to keep careful statistics, and he found this. If any patient in his ward had a fever, high temperature, other people in the ward would also get that, but not necessarily the ones closest or of the same age or from the same area. And he thought he detected again a pattern of transmission by the visiting medical staff. So then he said, if anybody examines a patient with a fever before they touch anybody else, they must wash their hands. The reaction of the professor of that was so strong that Semmelweis was booted out of the hospital. Couldn't get another job anywhere in medicine in Austria, went back to his home country, where he worked for a little while in Budapest, Hungary, for about 6 months, trying to institute the same procedures there, lost his job there, never got another job in medicine, died in the year 1874 in a mental institution, because he was convinced that very well-meaning, very intelligent people were actually transmitting disease, suffering, and death to hospital patients because they refused to wash in between examinations. The first place in the world to institute a law that doctors must wash their hands before they examine a patient, the year was 1922, and the place was Great Britain. But if you go to a sink and you put in a plug and you turn on the faucets, taps, spigots, whatever you call them, until you've got enough water in there, and then you shut them off, then you wash your hands, then you pull out the plug, you have infected the taps, the plug, and the whole of the wash basin. The next person to come there will pick it up. So if you watch a doctor on one of these hospital movies, the taps, if it's a fairly old movie, the taps have a long arm on the tap. And the doctor comes in and he turns them on with his elbows. And he leaves the water running and he washes his hands under running water, which is washed straight down the drain. The tap's not infected, the wash basin is not infected. And when it's over, then he shuts them off. More modern hospitals don't even allow that, and the taps are operated either by the feet or the knees. So it's impossible for the doctor to touch anything with those infected hands. The first place in the world to institute a law that a doctor must wash himself under running water, the year was 1960, and the place was the state of California. In 1960, California caught up with Moses. years later. The Old Testament is an amazing, amazing book because of its advanced health rules. I've only picked out two. There are other ones. If you want to read about them, there's a book called None of These Diseases. Author is an American medical doctor called Macmillan. I've forgotten who publishes that one. It's fairly readily available, though. So the Old Testament is an amazing book. Sacred to Muslim, sacred to Jew, and to Christian. Started 1500 BC, finished 400 BC. But it's like a mystery novel, a well-written one. And you come to the Old Testament, you find some amazing figures. You find the seed of a woman that's going to crush a serpent. You find, turn please to Luke 24. Luke 24. You find a high priest with remarkable robes who can represent people in the presence of God. You find a suffering servant who is despised and rejected of men. You find a glorious king who's going to come and reign forever. You find a goat that is turned out into the desert and set free in the desert. You find a lamb that is killed and its blood applied on the lintel and the doorposts of the homes. You find all kinds of things, but it's difficult to fit them together. Because the Old Testament is like a well-written detective novel, like, say, an Agatha Christie. If you read an Agatha Christie, on page one, somebody is bumped off. By the time you get to the end of chapter one, your job for the rest of the book is to decide who done it. And by the end of chapter one, you think the whole book's going to be a waste of time because you're not. I mean, it's so obvious. You've got it all worked out. The whole thing is cracked, solved. It was the butler. Why bother reading any more? Chapter one, and you've got it. Till you read chapter two, when the butler gets murdered, so he can't be the murderer. But by the end of chapter two, you think you know. It's the brother. Has to be the brother. Got it all solved by the end of chapter two. Till you read chapter three, and you find it's not the brother, because he has an absolutely cast iron alibi. But by the end of chapter three, then you know who it was. It was that mysterious doctor from Europe who's just moved into the area and has dark glasses and looks suspicious. Must be him, obviously. And you've got all the clues fitted together until you read chapter four, when you discover that that doctor is actually in love with the heroine, so he must be the hero, so he can't be the villain. And so it goes on. In each chapter, you get a new suspect until you get to the last chapter when you haven't a clue. Well, that's not quite true. You've got about 50 clues, but you can't fit them together. You have no idea who is responsible for these murders until you read next to the last page. The last page is where the big romance comes out. Next to the last page is where you discover who the murderer is. And when you do, you say, Of course. It is so obvious. It's been staring you in the face all the time. And right from chapter 1, all the clues fit together. Everything makes sense. Now they've told you. You know, it's all there. It's a comprehensive book. And the theme runs all the way through it. And once you know the answer, you can see it. But the Old Testament is like that, except it hasn't told you what it's about. Because the answer to the Old Testament is a New Testament. It's a book about Jesus. Look with me in Luke 24. It says, the day of the resurrection, two people on the way to Emmaus, they're disciples, but they have completely given up. And they've given up all hope. Verse 25. He said to them, how foolish you are and slow of heart in coming round to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them, that is the word, he expounded to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Beginning with Moses, that's the first five books. And all the prophets, that's all the rest. To expound means to take the meaning that is in there, bring it out and make it obvious. It is the opposite of distorting and putting a foreign meaning on it. You bring out the contained meaning and make it to be seen. And he expounded to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Now they knew him. They'd known him for 3 years. And they knew the scriptures because they were Jews. But they'd never seen that the scriptures that they knew were actually a book about the Jesus that they knew. Until he brought the meaning out. And the seed of the woman is Jesus. And the glorious king who's going to rule forever is Jesus. And the goat turned loose in the desert is Jesus. And the suffering servant despised and rejected is Jesus. And the great high priest is Jesus. And the lamb whose blood is applied in the sign of a cross is Jesus. And he's in there from beginning all the way. It's a book about Jesus. Their reaction, verse 32, they asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the way and he opened to us the scriptures? And they were getting more and more excited as all these scriptures that they'd known from years came alive as he opened them. So, see, that's exactly what you should have expected. You should have known I was going to be crucified in Jerusalem. You should have known I was going to rise again. You should have known I was going to open the eyes of the blind and raise the dead. You should have known. Very quickly, give me two more minutes, would you? Acts 17. Verse 2. As his custom was. In other words, this is standard procedure, as his custom was. Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. So that was his standard. He didn't appeal to emotions. He didn't say this will make you happy forever after, or you better do this or you go to hell. He just reasoned with them and proved from the scriptures that they already had that Jesus was the Christ. Coming to the same chapter, verse 11, he's left Thessalonica, gone to Berea. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. And I believe there should be in there a therefore. Some manuscripts leave it out, most of them put it in. Therefore, many of the Jews believed. Not because they were gullible, but because they were prepared to go back to the scriptures and check, does it really say that? Hey, it does. Isn't this fantastic? And therefore, many of them believed. They were open-minded, diligent, careful, checked the scriptures, and therefore believed. Then, into chapter 18, there you meet several times in the chapter a man called Apollos, who really knew the scriptures very, very well, but he was a disciple of John the Baptist and he wasn't a Christian. Verse 24. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. In other words, they told him that Jesus had actually come, because he didn't know that. Verse 27. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was a Christ. So this was not done in secret, it was done in public, it was done in debate. Let's get at the truth, let's discuss it, let's argue it out.